and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a horrifying display of unpresidential behavior at Trump's Florida rally last Wednesday, where he again invoked the specter of caravans of immigrants heading north to invade our country, saying, "But how do you stop these people?" At which point, someone in the crowd shouted out, "Shoot them." To which Trump responded with a chuckle. Then, as if endorsing what was said, Trump shook his head and smiled, saying, "That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement." Jennifer Machia, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University and an historian of American presidential rhetoric, who is finishing a new book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery, joins us to discuss this new low in essentially declaring open season on immigrants trying to cross the southern border. This at a time when the leader of a far-right militia group operating on the New Mexico border was arrested for making similar threats to shoot unarmed asylum seekers, who Trump is demonizing. Now that Trump is in full campaign mode, we are reminded at every rally that Trump is a national disgrace and that we can only expect this dangerous incitement of racist vigilantism to get worse as Trump fires up his populist base with imaginary white genocide grievance as he distracts those he has betrayed by taking care of the 1%, not the people who voted for him. Then we look further into the issue of the border and deeper into the history of the border's role in the construction of our national identity and whether the American frontier ethos has hit a wall, with Trump having found a way to superficially acknowledge the limits of growth without addressing its complexities. In an age where average Americans are realizing that their country no longer wins foreign wars, we'll look into how much the imperial appetite has been redirected inwards as this administration further militarizes the border and incites racial terror against immigrants, many of whom came to America seeking refuge from political violence in their countries, which in many ways is a legacy of Cold War U.S. foreign policy in Central America. Greg Grandin, a professor of history at New York University, joins us to discuss his new book, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America, in which he writes, quote, "Trumpism is extremism turned inward, all-consuming and self-devouring. There is no divine messianic crusade that can harness and redirect passions outward. Expansion in any form can no longer satisfy interest, reconcile contradictions, dilute the factions, or redirect the anger." Then finally, we will speak with Henri Barkey, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, who served as a member of the State Department's policy planning staff and is the author of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, "Erdogan just committed political suicide by overturning an election in Istanbul. He may have triggered a Turkish spring." We will assess how long it will take for the Turkish people to get rid of their dictator, a question that could also be asked of the American people. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Jennifer Machia, who is a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, a historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a new book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Machia.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. And as you can tell from my introduction, I was appalled by what the president said last Wednesday at a rally on the Florida Panhandle. How did it strike you?
Yeah, I think you're right to be horrified. You know, part of it is Trump making a joke out of it, right? And that's horrifying enough. But then there's the fact that his audience just loves the joke. They laugh and laugh and laugh. They're having a great time, you know, contemplating this really terrible reality, which is that, you know, Trump is saying, yeah, it might be fine to shoot people at the border.
Well, he said that only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement. But it's sort of implied you can get away with it. I mean, that contrast that, for example, to when John McCain was running for president, where a woman said that Obama's a Muslim, and he said, no, he's not. He's a decent Christian man, and we have our differences, but he's not a Muslim. And that, I think, is a stark contrast to this incumbent that we have now. Is there any record? I mean, do you have to go back to Andrew Jackson? Is there any record of any American president behaving in such a reckless and demagogic way?
Yeah, I think that the comparison to McCain in that moment that you describe is a really good one. And I guess, you know, what Trump did in saying that this person could get away with saying that, you know, if you've read How Democracies Die, which is a book by political scientists Levitsky and Ziblatt, maybe Ziblatt and Levitsky, they give four criteria for how we know we have an authoritarian who is running for president or who is, you know, trying to take over the government. And one of their four criteria is condoning the violence against their opposition, or condoning the removal of civil liberty protections from other people, right? And so what Trump has done in that moment, and I think that you're right, that it is startling how he responds, is that he has done that thing that shows that he's an authoritarian. And he does it in such a way, and this is the way that Trump has gotten away with things heretofore, right, is that he does it in such a way that you can't tell if he's being serious or if he's just joking. And it's that ambiguity, it's that plausible deniability that provides Trump every time with this out, right, to say, oh, I was just joking. You know, somebody in my audience made, you know, a statement. I don't know if he means it or not, but I made it a joke. We all laughed and had a good time. That'll be his defense. But well, is that really defensible?
Well, but as I mentioned in the intro, there was an arrest recently by the FBI in New Mexico on the border with Mexico. The leader of the United Constitutional Patriots was arrested, and he and his militia group had been arresting at gunpoint migrant families and detaining them on the border. And they also, you know, practice target shooting with pictures of Mexicans. So, you know, I'm not sure that this particular character has actually shot anybody, but the fact that he's been arrested and he posed a considerable danger, according to the FBI, to children and families around him. I don't think it's a big leap to make. The leap from Trump's rhetoric to the reality of people like this guy the FBI just arrested.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I'm sure your audience is familiar with the term stochastic terrorism, right? Which is to say that, you know, Trump's rhetoric may not have an exactly precise impact on every single person, but statistically we can say that there's a probability that it will have this kind of effect. And in terms of holding Trump accountable, you know, he's just going to say, well, I don't know anything about that vigilante group. I didn't tell them to do that, right? I can't be held accountable for what my words might have incited in others. That's, you know, that's them. That's not me. And that's, again, how he has been able to get out of all of these situations that he has, in fact, caused. You know, he did some things where, because of him, white nationalists attacked journalists. Right, and when we asked him about it, when he was asked about it, he said, "Oh, I don't know. You know, I did. Are they fans of mine? I don't know anything about that." Right? He's done this consistently for 3.5 years, and no one's been able to pin him down for it.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a new book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. So where do you think the American people stand then on a tradition that one assumes in our history that since we don't have royalty here, the revolution was against a relative of Queen Elizabeth, George III, and the Mad King, and there was even a move when Washington was the first president to make him king. And of course, if you read the press, I think in this country they're gushing more over the royal baby than they are in the UK. But nevertheless, we don't have a king. And so because our president is both the head of the state in the ceremonial sense that Queen Elizabeth is, and also the political head, then, to some extent vested in our presidents is an expectation of some decorum as the head of state. What happened to that?
Yeah. I think that that's a great question. I recently was looking at YouGov polling about which politicians in the world Americans prefer, and they were all the English royalty. So there might be some switch happening in America, but they might like a monarch. But perhaps you're right. I mean, there is certainly an expectation of decorum. Jay Rosen made a really great point, I thought. He's a journalism professor at NYU, I'm sure you know. Made a really great point to me a few years ago. He said that, we have these expectations for the president so much because the president can, destroy the world, right? And so whether or not this person is legitimately heroic or smart or prudent or, decorous or whatever, the fact that they have all this power to kill us all through launching nuclear war means that we put so much on them, that we want so much from them. It seems to me that Trump is not satisfying any of those things, except for those people who are in his audience there who are laughing, right? Those people, Trump's base, they love what he's doing. And I don't think it's about them wanting, someone who's a decorous head of state, which might be something that you and I want. But I think it's more like they think that the system is so absurd and it's so corrupted and it's so broken that only someone who is himself so absurd and corrupt and broken can lead us out of the mess, right? That this is the president that America deserves, in a way, which is a really troubling place to be in the nation.
Well, it indicates such an extraordinary alienation from our politics, in the sense that people who think Trump is breaking the mold and that business as usual is unsupportable. And I mean, I understand why they feel that this government is not serving their interests, because it's not. It hasn't. It tends to serve the interests of the rich and powerful, who are the campaign donors. But ironically, Trump has taken that in the most grotesque way, where he literally, his only achievement is the so-called tax reform bill. And it just so clearly rewards the super rich and shafts everybody else. And yet, that's the connection I can't follow. Why do you think the base doesn't notice how he's governing? They love the rallies, they love the rhetoric, but they seem to be impervious to the reality of what Trump's priorities are, and those priorities do not include his base.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's deeply ironic. You're right. This is a really frustrated and alienated, and rightfully so, I think. The government has not worked for them. It's been dominated by public relations and political consultants for the last 40 years, and that certainly hasn't helped the average citizen. You know, Hannah Arendt said in Origins of Totalitarianism, which I'm sure everyone's been quoting on your shows lately, but she talks about the way that gullibility and cynicism worked to help propel Nazism in Germany. And what she said is that people were so alienated from German culture that they expected everything to be a lie. And when they saw that their team was lying better than the other team, they cheered that, right? You know, it's all lies, but my guy's the best liar there is out there. So I love my guy because he lies better than the rest and they're all liars. You know, so I think that there's something about that us versus them mentality that Trump is so good at reinforcing. Polarization has been his winning strategy up till now. And, you know, we just marked, what is it, the 10,000th lie or something like that that Trump has told in office. His people cheer that. They're like, great, he's doing such a good job of lying to these liars. We wish that, you know, our guys would have lied to them before now. It's really, really a frightening, in my mind, it's a frightening alienation from American politics. And I'm not sure how we move forward from this. I mean, it's really, this level of polarization is not something that we can easily overcome.
Well, the irony is, of course, that the alienated Trump base are engaged in the sense that they voted. And Hillary Clinton lost because in some of those key states, because obviously the Russians interfered, and Jill Stein took more votes than Hillary lost by in those three states. But still, a lot of people simply didn't show up because they weren't inspired. They'd voted for Obama, but they didn't show up for Hillary Clinton. So obviously, you know, turnout is what it's all about. But we have a tyranny of the minority. At best, Trump's base is, what, 40% thereabouts. That means there's 60% majority that don't support him. And I suspect that majority is getting greater. But how do you inspire them? I know there's like 20-something candidates running against him trying to be the inspirer-in-chief, and I'm not sure how that's going. But in a, just to focus in on, if I were a Latino or you know, descendant from a Mexican or Central American refugees living here in the United States as an American citizen, I would be absolutely appalled that this guy is basically putting a target on my back and my people's back. And that's what he's doing. I don't think there's any two ways about it. So is that going to translate? Because the Latino constituency is the one that's the hardest to motivate. They tend not to vote. The young also tend not to vote. African Americans do vote. But do you think there could be a change that the Latinos are going to come out and vote in 2020?
Well, I think that people are going to try to motivate them to vote for sure. You know, it's really hard to predict what turnout's going to be this far out. I have seen a lot of energy, you know, even throughout the state of Texas, I've seen a lot of energy for the 2018 campaign. You know, so we'll see what happens with turnout. You know, based on my research on presidential rhetoric and the way that you need to pretend to be or convince the nation that you are a hero, the right hero for the moment during a presidential campaign, I think that the 2020 electorate is going to want a hero who has credibility in preventing corruption, right, in regulation. You know, and those aren't necessarily sexy topics every election cycle. But I think that in 2020, it might be a year where, you know, we are looking for people to make real regulations, real changes in banking industry, in loan industry, in the environment, in government, right? All of these different areas that people are frustrated with what seems to be, you know, corruption running rampant. Somebody who might have credibility in that, stemming corruption, might be the right candidate for 2020. We'll see.
Well, Jennifer Machia, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a new book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking further into the issue of the border and deeper into the history of the border's role in the construction of our national identity.
Been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Greg Grandin, who's a professor of history at New York University. His books include Empire's Workshop, Kissinger's Shadow, and The Empire of Necessity, which won the Bancroft Prize. His book, Fordlandia, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. And his latest book just out is The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Greg Grandin.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, thank you, Greg, for joining us. And what did you make of President Trump's remarks we just were talking about and in the first segment here today on Wednesday down in the Florida Panhandle, where he was again invoking the specter of these caravans of migrants heading north to invade our country? And he said, but how do you stop these people? At which point someone in the crowd shouted out, shoot them, to which Trump responded with a chuckle. Then, as if endorsing what was said, Trump shook his head and smiled, saying, that's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement. I found it appalling. Our previous guest, who's an historian of presidential rhetoric, thinks it's an all-time low in terms of presidential rhetoric. How did it strike you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was appalling also. I mean, it really is just an example of how Trump is unleashing or extending a kind of notion of freedom. You know, America stands for freedom. And in the long course of U.S. history, there's different competing meanings of how to define freedom, but certainly one of them is freedom from restraint. You know, and Trump has turned that into a kind of narcissistic petulance that that is sanctioning all sorts of insidious and dangerous behavior, from pulling out of the Paris climate talks to encouraging his supporters to the worst acts of violence. This is just a kind of really drawing out a kind of petulant narcissism that Trump has embodied. And I don't think he's a complete break with U.S. history. I think there's currents of this kind of disregard and cruelty that run through. I mean, the United States is a settler colonial society founded on chattel slavery and the genocide of Native Americans. So there's quite a bit of cruelty in its history. But Trump is pulling that out into the future and turning cruelty itself into a cultural banner that he waves at his followers.
Well, to my mind, he's doing it simply to distract his base, because he's essentially, those people that cheer him are essentially the people he has betrayed. He has taken care of the 1%, not them. So that's my cynical interpretation, or not, maybe it's realistic too. How do you interpret it, his motivation?
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree that's exactly what the wall is. That's exactly what the nativism is. When Trump came to power promising to overturn the whole previous order, which included the Republican Party's Koch brother agenda, and basically he's just accelerated that agenda. And the deregulation, the corporate power, the inequality. I mean, there's not the only thing that he really does have is the border and the nativism, which has become the kind of binding agent for a political coalition that was promised something much different, and all they have is the cruelty, and that is centered around the border wall. So yes, it is both a rallying cry and a distraction, I think.
So what do you think is, and I asked this of our previous guest, I'm always astounded that we have a tyranny of the minority. We're heading into constitutional crisis territory. There's about 20 congressional inquiries now that Trump is blocking, and about 80 requests for documentation and other material that he's blocking from the Congress. Yet he's still a minority president. He's gone up a little bit in the polls, but he's still a minority president, and always was. He lost by more than 3 million votes. So the question always comes up, what's wrong with majority? If this guy's only got 40%, how come the 60%? Is it simply our winner-take-all system that means we got to suck it up until someone shows up to get rid of this guy?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm no political theorist or institutionalist, but I do know that that setting aside questions of political culture and ideology, just the structures of U.S. democracy are stacked against democracy. I mean, you can go through any number of the Electoral College, the Senate, the gerrymandering. I mean, they all are designed to put brakes on majority rule and democratic rule. So even and the voters, that's not even mentioning voter suppression and all of the mechanisms that the Republican Party has put into place once they realized that there was a demographic change afoot that might sink them as a national political party. But setting all of that, so that's even before you get to questions of racism and ideology and political culture and what is it about the United States. But Trump, I guess he got 35-40% of the country behind him, no matter what he does. I guess that it's a good indicator of the settler colonial vote, the racist vote, the white supremacist and nativist vote. Pretty much nothing he can do that could shake that. You know, I mean, what I find it touching when all of these Democrats or Democratic advisors, you know, they read a report in the New York Times about how it's all flim-flam, you know, how it's that Trump is basically P.T. Barnum, you know, and he's been doing it for years. And they keep on thinking that that story is what's going to lose his base. You know, okay, this story that proves that he really was bankrupt, this is what's really going to turn his base against him. And of course it's not true, because first of all, one, in American culture, the flim-flam artist who goes on to great power is a much beloved character, and Trump's success is evident in the fact that he won the presidency. So they're not going to, none of these stories are going to turn his base against him.
Right, but you still keep wondering when the majority, the 60% majority, they have been able to find somebody to coalesce around. Obviously, they've got a big field of Democrats, but in general, I see sort of passivity in the minority and activism in the I see passivity in the majority and activism in the minority.
Yeah, I guess a majority 30-40% can win the presidency, as we've seen happen, as long as there's no alternative coalition with a compelling message. And we see the fight within the Democratic Party. I mean, and the fault lines are deep among a lot of different issues: Medicare for all, Israel, foreign policy. You know, and as long as no other coalition could coalesce a moral vision that could you know, kind of gain momentum and present itself as in the best interest, as an ascendant governing alliance, then a minority can continue to win elections. And there's so much stacked against the Democrats. The Democratic Party is sclerotic. I mean, you have. I mean, they won't. The divisions are deep.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, who's a professor of history at New York University. His books include Empire's Workshop, Kissinger's Shadow, and The Empire of Necessity, which won the Bancroft Prize. His book, Fordlandia, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the National Books Critics Circle Award. And his latest book just out is The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. So let's talk about the book in terms of the big picture here. It's often been said that the federal budget is the country's DNA. Certainly, it displays what our priorities are and who we take care of and who we don't take care of as a nation. And we take care of the Defense Department in a way that's just mind-boggling. We are spending more on defense today than we spent at the height of the Cold War, when we had a real enemy that could have wiped us off the map in about half an hour. We don't have anybody out there that threatens us. We've got, you know, some make-believe enemies, and they've just rounded up most of the ISIS people. In fact, the reason that the Secretary of Defense Mattis resigned was that Trump was about to pull the plug on the U.S. Mission there that was helping the Kurds process all of these prisoners that are coming out of the rubble who could come back and kill us. He was about to let them loose. I mean, it's amazing. The reckless nature of Trump's foreign policy, but still, how do you tie that into your border thesis? Because if we've reached a point now where even the most sort of ardent Trumpster still questions whether or not we win wars anymore, how is he getting away with it? Spending, he keeps saying we need more on defense, but defense against what?
Yeah, it's not so much that they'll still be spending money on defense, and I mean that the defense budget has a life of its own. It's almost like a living organism at this point with its own. You know, it's impossible to actually get a single view of it from any particular angle. It's so amorphous and it's so enormous. I mean, it has sources of funding that aren't even in the budget when they talk about $700 billion or $800 billion. The thesis of the book is more that the U.S. doesn't have an ideological mission abroad. Trump is continuing the bombing. He's expanded the bombing. He's expanded the drone warfare. I presume that we're torturing people in interrogation camps. But the ability to use those wars as a kind of moral crusade to vent the extremism or to give the U.S. purpose in order to solidify and consolidate a domestic political coalition is what Trump doesn't have, and Obama didn't have it either. Obama stabilized the excesses of the previous regime that got us into Iraq and Afghanistan and drove the United States to the precipice. Obama stabilized it, and he turned the war on terror into an exercise in pragmatism. But he could no longer point beyond the frontier and say, there, beyond the frontier, is where we will settle our differences. There, we will find purpose. There, we will find unity, right? And without that ability to use war and use expansion as a kind of moral accelerator and galvanizer and consolidator, everything began to unravel under Obama, and it's continuing to unravel under Trump. War is no longer the solution. But we have so the argument of the book is that Trumpism is what happens when the empire ends. And all of the violence and racism and craziness and extremism and the furies that used to be vent outward now turn inward. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the U.S. doesn't have an unparalleled foreign policy establishment. All the structures of authority are still in place, 800 military bases. We're running 6 or 7 wars. Who knows how many wars we're running? We still have the dollar is still fairly dominant, but we've lost the moral legitimacy of an international order based on limitless growth, and that's what's different.
Well, so you know, there's always been the question of will the republic survive the empire, and you would think as the empire crumbles, not that it's not being sustained by any less money, but the Chinese don't invest anything like what we're doing in defense, but they certainly are spending a lot of money on their Belt and Road Initiative and others. And they're the number two economy. And there's now, of course, Trump's sort of started a trade war with China. When the arena shifts from the basic loss of U.S. hegemony in the world and the rise of China hegemony, how does that impact your thesis and particularly the people who support Trump?
What's that? The rise of China?
Yeah. In other words, yeah. that we're no longer, you know, at some point or other, we may not be the global hegemon, what we spend all this money on defense to be that way. And the Chinese are basically saying we don't need a big fleet like you guys have and waste all that money. We're going to just, you know, go ahead and do what we're doing. And frankly, they're doing pretty well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, and in the book I talk. The three variables that lead to the closing of the empire and the realization that there are limits and the end of the ability to use the promise of limitless growth in order to organize domestic politics is the exhaustion of the neoconservative military project. Two is the collapse of the growth model in 2007 and 2008. And then three is climate change. I mean, but certainly China, these are very big ways of talking about a lot of different things. Certainly China would fall into the exhaustion of the neoliberal growth model because China was integrated into that model. And so as China arises itself as its own interest and with its own interests and possibly setting limits on what U.S. can do, you know, the United States is a nation that doesn't know how to live within its borders. And it's increasingly finding itself in a world where it has to live within its borders. The solutions are no longer out there. And so far, we're not having a very good go at it.
So, Greg Grandin, we're very grateful to be able to have another conversation with you. We got tremendous response the last time we spoke. So tell me, Greg, what you think our audience needs to know about your book.
Well, I think the book explains the border crisis. I think it explains all of these crazy stories that we're hearing that's hard to process, the violence of the Border Patrol, the locking up of kids, the moral collapse of a nation that has now thousands of children in detention that are being forced adopted into Christian homes that are linked to petty divorce. Some of them are being drugged so they could sleep. They're not being given drugs to heal when they're sick. The way the border has become a flashpoint in terms of declaring states of emergencies and just the way and power of the wall as a central icon in America's symbol, how quickly it became a symbol of American politics. And my book explains that history, how we got here. And it starts off looking at the frontier, looking at the United States as a unique history, a unique nation that no other nation in world history had for so long been able to organize its domestic politics through the promise of expansion, continental expansion, military expansion, market expansion, cultural and political expansion, if you will. And, as the U.S. kind of whirled across the continent and then across the Pacific, you know, nothing was in its way, and it seemed like the frontier was infinite. And those days are gone. That ended. That ended with the Iraq War. That ended with climate change. That ended with the financial collapse. And now we're living in a moment in which the extremism and violence that used to be, not all the time, but to a large degree, marginalized, kept on the fringes of society. Trumpism isn't anything new. We've seen expressions of Trump and the race realism and the racism that he embodies throughout all of history. But for the most part, maybe at least since Andrew Jackson, it's remained on the margins. Fringe, George Wallace, Father Coughlin, other expressions of racism. What Trump's, you know, extremism's taking national power now, it's not just any other moment in national history. It's a moment when the U.S. has lost its ability to use limitless growth in order to organize domestic politics. And it's in that context that the border wall becomes a rallying symbol. And basically, it supplants the frontier as the main symbol in U.S. history right now, where the frontier used to symbolize moving out in the world, the future, the United States becoming more liberal, more international. It used to symbolize the promise of endless growth. The border wall represents exactly the opposite. It's a place of enervating, where all of the past wars become collapse into one war, all of these veterans from all of the United States' failed campaigns come back and rehearse how they could have won. It's where the trauma that can no longer be rolled over into frontier wars starts to become all-consuming domestically. And it becomes the symbol of the opposite of a politics of the frontier that said all boats can rise, everybody can sit at the table, there's enough for everybody, win-win. The border wall represents a kind of race realism that says the frontier is closed, that there's not enough to go around. We have to take care of our own. How the country went from go west to go away.
Well, that is a grim reality, but I must say some of this, what you just brought up there, Greg Grant, and it got my attention when you talked about Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, who, of course, wears her Christian dogma on her sleeve. The idea that she's running a program, or the Trump administration is running a program to forcibly adopt these young kids and drug them to get them to sleep but not give them the kind of medicine they need is just so straight out of The Handmaid's Tale. It just, you know, it really got my attention. I'm going to have to do a follow-up interview about that with some people. But just elaborate on a little bit, if you will, because that seems to be one of the cruelest things I've ever heard, and we're talking about cruelty here.
Yeah, well, I mean, every day the scenes of cruelty that come from the border are just hard to process. I mean, they just the drop, even when they drop asylum seekers off, they just drop them in the middle of nowhere. They have no way to get home. They're separated. They're still separating children from their parents. The Department of Health and Human Service can't say how many children they have in detention. Thousands of children have been placed in homes, and the government is saying that they have no way to match them with their family. They don't know where they came from. And then there's a subset of that have been actually forced, adopted into a Christian adoption agency that is affiliated with Betsy DeVos, as far as I know. So that's just one episode in the parade of horror stories that we're seeing at the border. You know, another way of thinking about it is, you know, for a long time that there were two opposing ways of thinking how tyranny was going to come to the United States. If you were a leftist, you would think that a fascist state would rise up to break and put down a threatening workers' movement. You know, if you're on the right, you think tyranny comes when, you know, the soft control of an ever-bureaucratizing state starts telling you what size sodas you can drink, or what you can and can't do, and you know, try to create a soft citizenry subordinated to the bureaucracy. But in reality, the United States, tyranny comes from its exceptional border. We should stop talking about frontier exceptionalism and start talking about border exceptionalism. Starting in the 1970s, for a lot of different reasons, there was an increasing demand to seal the border. And everybody bought into it, the Democrats, the Republicans. And from that point on, the Border Patrol, the number of Border Patrol agents shot up, the number of money spent, the technology deployed. The border is impossible to seal. It's impossible to seal because of its geography. It's 2,000 miles long. But it's also impossible to seal because it's the central axis on which North American capitalism runs and functions. It's not just any other border. It's not like the border between Venezuela and Colombia or between Russia and China. It's the fulcrum of North American capital. But the constant call to seal the border has created a demand that can't be satisfied. And yet at the same time that demand is greeted with ever more attempts to placate the demand with more troops, more weapons, more high-tech sensors, more blimps and drones and ground sensors and tripwires and whatever you want, smart walls, troops at the border, National Guard at the border. And it's not stopping people from coming or from getting in. And so over the years, you know, we've had this border brutalist movement making these demands that the border be sealed, and those demands, the border was never sealed, but the demands were met in terms of how much hardware was deployed, how much money was deployed. And so we're at a point now where, you know, the Constitution doesn't hold 100 miles in from the border. There are workplace raids. I mean, getting back to my original point, that what is unique about the United States is that tyranny seems to be, when tyranny comes, it's where it comes from, the unique history and function of the border in U.S. society.
Well, of course, politically too, there's a confusion because there's a de facto alliance between the right-wing Chamber of Commerce, who want cheap labor, and the MALDEF and these other left-wing groups in support of immigrants. And then on the other side, you've got an alliance between, on the left, between labor unions and right-wing Minutemen. So it's politically, it's not as straightforward. And the Democrats, as appalling as Trump's policies are, the Democrats don't really have a policy on the border.
No, and the leadership, at least, continues to feed into the idea of security first.
Right.
I mean, at least since Reagan, the policy, the answer, whenever pressed, was security first and then a one-off reform. I mean, there's two problems with that. You can't secure the border. The border is not securable for all sorts of reasons. You can't get to the point that would satisfy the people who say security first. The second problem with that is that you can't just have a one-off reform, say, we're going to create a path to citizenship for everybody who's in the country, because they're not going to stop coming, because it's the nature of North American capitalism, right? So we're just, you know, having a one-off reform like Reagan did and what George W. Bush wanted and what Obama wanted isn't a solution. I mean, we didn't even get that one-off reform under Bush and Obama, but even if we did, that wouldn't be the solution, because it doesn't address the core problem of migration and cheap labor and how dependent the country is on cheap labor on both sides of the border.
And Greg Grander, we won't keep you much longer, but do you think there is a way? I mean, obviously, we have an extraordinary at this moment. We're in what is a constitutional crisis, and it's likely to get more intense. I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like this. We do have a mob boss in the Oval Office who's behaving in a way that no American president has before, and they've already thumbed their nose at, 20 congressional inquiries. They're not even going to allow the full Mueller report to be made available, even though Trump himself said it exonerated him, and then he turns around and sequesters it, or sent, you know, and I think not only are they they're blocking 20 investigations, they're apparently holding up about 80 requests for documentation, etc. So this is an amazing standoff. How much do you think in the as the opposition in this country tries to form a narrative with it being dispersed amongst 20 plus candidates? How do you see the immigration issue and what you brought to the table about rethinking the frontier myth? How would you say that might play into a narrative that's necessary to win in 2020?
Well, I don't – so Biden is being – supposedly has the momentum, and he pretty much represents exactly the opposite of what the common sense was just a little while ago, that we had to offer an alternative to Trump and Trumpism, and not just go, not just a promise to go back to the status quo ante, much less the status quo ante somebody like Biden, who's responsible for so many of the problems. He voted for the Iraq War. He voted for, you know, in favor of bankruptcy law. He voted for the repeal of regulations on the finance sector. I mean, he voted for all of those crime bills. I mean, he really is kind of not just the status quo ante. He's in many ways the symbol of how the establishment exhausted itself and gave way to somebody like Trump. Now, I think that my personal opinion is that the opponents of Trump do have to have a new myth. They do have to have a different way of talking about America. I don't think that centrism can hold. So part of the argument of my book is that the frontier, constant expansion, forget frontier, constant expansion, and the ability and the promise of limitlessness and the promise of endless growth, marginalize two extremes. It marginalized to some degree the extremism of that is now running the country, and then marginalized the nativism, the racism, the violence inherent in settler colonialism. But it also marginalized a social democratic challenge to capital and property. And it put forward a kind of centrist property rights universalism as the highest expression of liberalism. And it worked. I mean, but it could only work as long as expansion remained viable. Now that expansion has collapsed, that kind of middle of the road centrism, whatever you want to call it, neoliberalism, market oriented capitalism, whatever, third wayism, can't sustain itself. And what we're seeing now with the collapse of the promise of limitless growth is that the U.S. is facing a choice that other countries that didn't have the privilege of being able to deflect its contradictions outward long ago faced, and that's the choice between barbarism or socialism. And I think that that's the choice that this country faces. I think that, you know, barbarism we already have. That won the national election in 2016. Socialism was on the docket, or at least it was in the primary of the other major political party, and it seems to be gaining in popularity now. I don't know if it can win in the Democratic Party as the Democratic Party is now constituted, but certainly a majority of millennials believe that social rights are legitimate rights, believe that health care and education and the right to live a dignified life, that these are all legitimate rights, and that those are social rights. And that is a pretty radical belief in the United States, because the United States was founded on the idea of individual rights. The Bill of Rights protects individual rights. Congress shall make no law that infringes. So it's all about restraining the state. All of those other rights, education, health care, they require an expansion of the state in order to distribute wealth. And the fact that a majority of young people and a majority of immigrants, and I think a lot of the anti-nativist fever that overcomes the Republicans is really about this. Many immigrants also believe in social rights. So I think that is the new myth. That there's three myths at play. The myth of the frontier is gone. The myth of the border wall is having its run. But if decent people are to win, I think they're going to have to organize around a new myth, and that's the myth of social democracy. And by myth, I don't mean it's a lie. I mean it's a belief system that corresponds to reality.
Just in closing, Greg, just in terms of when you talked about the end of growth, it's just not a fact. It's also an imperative, isn't it? I mean, it's incompatible with climate change. In other words, climate change, Mother Nature is telling us that we've got to stop burning fossil fuels, for example. So much of our economy is based on that, and that you can see the resistance from the Koch brothers and others and the oil companies to that. But how do you see that as a rallying cry in the context of what you just said? In other words, we're all in Lifeboat Earth together, and the Koch brothers are drilling a hole through the lifeboat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think there's a temptation to think of Trump's wall as a more realistic way of thinking about how the world works. If we all agree that things can't go on the way they were going on, that there are limits, the frontier is closed, not everybody could sit at the table, not everybody can get in the lifeboat, you know, then the wall becomes a kind of more brutal symbol of a politics of domination that we might not like, but is supposedly a more realistic symbol of how things actually work. After all, the frontier was a mirage. You know, not everybody sat at the table. Not everybody, you know, not everybody benefited. But the wall has its own illusions. The illusion is that if we build the wall, then we could just continue going on as we were going on. Then we can roll coal and we can, you know, eat, you know, as much steak as we want. You know, we can murder somebody on Fifth Avenue, like Trump said. The magic trick, it's that if we build the wall, we have to build the wall because there's not enough. But implied in building the wall is that there will be enough for us once we build the wall. Do whatever we want, right? But it authorizes a kind of petulant hedonism that again goes back to what we talked about earlier, definition of freedom as freedom from restraint. And that definition understood in increasingly cruel terms, you know, culturally cruel terms. Like, who's to tell us we can't put children in detention centers? Who's to tell us we can't pull out of the Paris Peace Treaty? Who's to tell us we can't outfit pickup trucks with, you know, these diesel, you know, exhausts that, you know, just as a way of trolling liberals, like it really is its own mystification. And yes, there is an imperative. It can't go on. But Trump is telling them if we build the wall, it can go on.
Greg, we're very grateful for the time you've given us here today. And we're very grateful for your new book, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America.
Well, thanks so much, Ian. It's always terrific speaking with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Greg Grandin, who's a professor of history at New York University. His books include Empire's Workshop, Kissinger's Shadow, and The Empire of Necessity, which won the Bancroft Prize. His book, Fordlandia, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the National Books Critics Circle Award. And his latest book just out is The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and a senior fellow of the Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. He has authored and co-authored a number of books, including Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Erdogan Just Committed Political Suicide. By overturning an election in Istanbul, he may have triggered a Turkish spring. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
So, obviously, Erdogan was rebuked in the last municipal elections where he lost, or his party lost control of all of the major cities. And that's pretty much, does that not reflect the kind of divide in Turkey, which is not dissimilar from the divide in this country, where you have in the red states, you have sort of religious people voting conservatively, and in the blue states, in this cities, they vote in more progressively. And the base for Erdogan seems to be, and his Islamist party seems to be in the countryside and not in the cities. So let's start with the premise. Has he gone too far in overturning these election results in Istanbul?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, he's gone way too far, and because he's also overturning the results on very shady grounds. I mean, the reason that they use for overturning the results are not being applied elsewhere. They're only being applied in places where the ruling party of Erdogan has lost. And even in Istanbul, they said that the reason they overturned it is that some of the election officials had not been properly vetted, yet each voter voted not only for the head of the whole municipality of Istanbul, but also for the local districts. They only overturned the overall municipality vote and not the local results. Presumably the same unvetted official was sitting there looking over both sets of voting. So it's completely, completely made up, completely fictitious reason. And the truth is, everybody knows it, and even some diehard AKP supporters are going to be very upset at this, because in Turkey, especially over the last decade or so, as institutions have lost their independence and Erdogan has increasingly, one by one, taken over these institutions, or, as in the case of the press, transferred them to his cronies, the electoral system, until recently, was seen as being fair. In 2017, there was a constitutional referendum in which it looked like at the last minute Erdogan was losing, so they did all kind of chicanery and changed the result. But in this particular case of Istanbul, because you had a contest between two individuals in the city, it's different than an amorphous constitutional amendment where, you know, there's nobody who's representing necessarily one side or the other. Istanbul, you had a mobilization behind an opposition mayoral candidate who played it very straight and very, very well, and really garnered a huge amount of support, and became very popular in the process. So now you have somebody who represents the opposition, who you can now you can see there's one person around which you can mobilize and galvanize the opposition. So people are going to, I think, to vote
massively, more so than last time, for this opposition candidate, except that Erdogan is going to probably try to make sure that by cheating, by pressuring people, by buying off certain segments of the population, will try to influence the outcome. That said, I think this is going to be a pyrrhic victory for him, because I think he has lost a great deal of his reputation in Turkey now, because people know that he has intervened massively, or is not recognizing the one institution that people had some faith in, and that was the electoral system. And this will have consequences. I mean, he may overturn the Istanbul decision and get his candidate to win Istanbul by, as I said, by chicanery, but people will never forget it. And that's going to undermine his legitimacy.
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University and a senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Policy. Erdogan just committed political suicide by overturning an election in Istanbul. He may have triggered a Turkish spring. Well, the elections that he's overturning the results of, at least in the main city of Istanbul, during those elections, Erdogan really went way over the top, or, you know, jumped the shark, as they say. He was absolutely despicable, literally using the footage of the assassin in New Zealand who murdered all of those people in a mosque. And apparently the helmet camera footage of this man killing all these innocent people is perhaps the most gruesome thing that anybody can look at. And yet he played clips of it and even made allusions to the New Zealanders landing at Gallipoli in 1915 and how they're going to send them all home in coffins, etc. It was absolutely, and then he turns around and writes a nice op-ed in the New York Times praising New Zealand's Prime Minister. He really is a pretty despicable person. And so is it simply like the appeal in this country for Trump? He just has a base that's immovable? Or do you think you can nibble away at his base? And you've made the case that maybe by overturning this election, I'm sure the people in the cities already loathe him, but will this affect the people in the countries?
No, I think we should be very careful about extending the making a comparison between what's happening in Turkey and the United States. I mean, yes, Trump may have a strong base here, just like Erdogan, but the difference is that the United States institutions are still independent. They're not about to be taken over by Mr. Trump, whereas in Turkey there's no free press. Whatever exists on the margins, on the internet, because every single newspaper, every single television station now does what the Soviet Union used to do, essentially cover only the president and only the interests of the president and his party. So that's one. Number two, you don't have any independent state institutions, whether it's the Supreme Court, the Electoral Council, any of the organizations of the state are now. There is no judicial system in Turkey. I mean, there is no rule of law. You can indict a ham sandwich if you want to. People are go to jail for no reason whatsoever and made up charges. Just like the Soviet Union and its affiliates used to be. So that comparison with the United States is not a valid one. Erdogan has become now a two-bit dictator. Maybe Mr. Trump may have similar fantasies, but he's not going to succeed, and the United States is not going to let the public and institutions, and as we see it with Congress, will not let it happen. In Turkey, there is no institution left that can withstand Mr. Erdogan. He owns the whole shebang, so to say.
And that includes the military, of course.
Yes, because what happened with the military is that when there was an attempted coup in July of 2016, he used that to essentially purge the military of all the officers he thought would not be loyal. So basically that meant all the officers who had pro-Western leanings. And so now you have a military that is far more docile. And look, there's a way in which a military should always be under civilian control. I don't think there was any reason to suspect the military the way he, or the leadership of the military that he got rid of in 2016. But the military should stay out of politics. I mean, it has a very checkered history in Turkey, where the military has attempted four coups in a very short period of time, or in the last 50 years, essentially, of the 20th century. So putting the military in its, shall we say, political cage is actually a good thing. But he's actually, what he's doing now, he's also politicizing the military. Right? He's trying to turn the military, just like Maduro has done in Venezuela. And I think Maduro is a much better comparison with Erdogan than Trump. Maduro has completely politicized the military, and Erdogan is beginning to do that. But more importantly, it's the fact that there is no serious opposition until this mayor of Istanbul emerged that has captured the imagination. There's opposition from minorities, especially the Kurds, and they were very instrumental in getting the mayor of the mayor of Istanbul, who lost his job, get elected, because the Kurds decided that they were going to vote against Erdogan, and they were going to vote for the one candidate who seemed most opposed and had the best chance of defeating Erdogan candidate. So you do have pockets of resistance in Turkey. What I'm arguing is that as people realize that there is no way to oppose Erdogan, we will see new forms of mobilization in Turkey. It's not going to be overnight. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be next year either. But over time, as people look for ways to dissent, they will realize that the normal channels of dissent and opposition no longer exist. And they will try to figure out other ways of mobilizing. And at the moment, the only other model we have is the Arab Spring. There may be other models which I haven't thought about, but at the moment, the Arab Spring is a potential model for Turkey, and we may see 3-4 years down the road demonstrations in all the major cities of Istanbul, of Turkey against the regime, and the regime going and trying to suppress them violently, which will create more resistance. That said, there's another important factor here, is that the Turkish economy is in doldrums, and under Erdogan now, despite the earlier success of Erdogan in the economy, now Erdogan is actually making the economic situation worse with poor decision making, and so as if the economy continues to do poorly, that will also galvanize an opposition to him. But that too will take time.
Well, you mentioned the comparisons with Erdogan and Maduro in Venezuela. Of course, Venezuela's economy is just absolutely in free fall, and people are really, hungry, and there's no medicine, and the best and brightest have already left. The country's falling apart, and yet he holds on to power. Turkey's not at that point. I understand the business community are disgusted with Erdogan because he's enriching his family and his cronies. But in the case, just following these analogies that you've brought up, the difference, of course, is certainly with Venezuela. The United States is doing everything it can to install this fellow Guaido, who so far has not been able to persuade the military to join him. There's no such effort coming from our administration that I know, even though Trump and Erdogan have a prickly relationship.
No, I wouldn't actually. In fact, I would not say that. In fact, Trump and Erdogan have actually, at that level, have a very good relationship. It's just the rest of the United States government that is upset at Erdogan's not behavior in terms of Turkish democracy, etc., but the purchase, for instance, of S-400 missiles from Russia that would endanger NATO equipment that Turkey is a member of the NATO alliance. Is those issues that are coming to the forefront. It has nothing to do with Erdogan's authoritarian tendencies. Look, the United States has done almost nothing to get some Americans who have, except for one person, a pastor, who was released last year. The United States has done very little to get Turkish Americans who were of Turkish descent who are in prison now. Has done nothing to criticize the fact that academics and journalists are in prison. So, and at the Trump-Erdogan level, and in fact Erdogan really counts on this, they have a fairly good relationship. I mean, they talk fairly often on the phone. Erdogan managed to convince Trump to get out of Syria, and that caused Secretary of Defense Mattis to resign in protest, and that decision was taken on the spur of the moment by Trump. And Erdogan thinks he can, he has a good enough relationship with Trump that he will convince Trump to do other things for him. So I wouldn't say that, certainly that there's a prickly relationship between the two. Absolutely not. I mean, yes, there's a problem with Russian missiles. Erdogan's support for Maduro, the problems on Syria, but the United States is actually going out of its way to find ways to satisfy the Turks in Syria. So it's not that relationship is not that bad. Congress is very upset. I mean, Congress is different. Congress, on a bipartisan level, is fairly upset at Turkish behavior, both in terms of democracy, human rights, freedom of the press, etc., and missiles, the S-400 missiles. But we don't see that coming from the administration. I would say even the administration's reaction to this really blatant attempt at overturning, well, not attempt, a successful overturning of the election results in Istanbul was very tepid. It didn't really say anything. I mean, and clearly this was, I mean, everybody, you don't have to be, people who are pro-Erdogan have criticized the way he has done it, and yet the State Department still issued a statement that, as I said, basically said nothing.
Right.
Just noted that what happened, So
closing, Henri, though, you know, I've made some analogies between the U.S. and Turkey and the polarization, the divide between the country and the cities, the urban, secular, and the rural, religious. At the end of the day, are you making the case just in the last minute that Trump likes Erdogan simply because Trump has despotic tendencies and he likes Putin, he likes Xi Jinping? Most of all, he likes the Korean, the most murderous leader on the planet, the North Korean.
No, there's no question that Trump has a tendency of, of having or trying to have good relations with despots. And by contrast, his relationship with Chancellor Merkel, who really represents the core of Europe's, shall we say, European principles today. He has a terrible relationship with Merkel. But look, there's another big difference between, I think, Trump and maybe the other leaders, is that Trump is very amazingly narcissistic and really thinks of every single issue from his own perspective. So And that allows other leaders to manipulate him and to tell him what he wants to hear. And it's easier for despots, whether it's Putin or Erdogan, to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to get that kind of, shall we say, behavior.
Adulation,
from,
right.
Or exactly, or Macron, or anybody else for that matter.
Right. Well, it's not. It doesn't go with democratic values. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate
thank you.
It. And again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey, Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University and a Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as a member of the United States Department, State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and is the author of a number of books, including Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and he has an article at Foreign Policy, Erdogan Just Committed Political Suicide. By overturning an election in Istanbul, he may have triggered a Turkish spring. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loves.